Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We're in paper 90 at the very beginning, which is old single column, page 986. Okay, as I was stating at the end of the preceding session, here we are again, ready to drop back and sweep through the whole panorama of the evolution of religion again, but this time focusing not on the concepts, of different flavor after different flavor, as we went back through, but this time we want to focus on the individuals that quickly became the orchestrators of the specifics of evolutionary religion, the shamans. And they're before they get into some of the kind of basic approaches that the shamans took to things, they want to just introduce the concept of the shamans. So that's where we start, and I'll make a few more comments about their basic nature once we read the first paragraph of the preface here. But it's a lot of how things came to be the way they are with evolutionary religion can't be understood as just by examining theoretically sort of the influences that humans are under and the way humans will naturally want to respond to those influences and how that evolves as humans bring in a little bit more of their personal nature, the way we've been talking about this stuff for quite a while now. A lot of it has specifically to do with the foibles of human behavior. So, that's why you have a whole paper dedicated to that, because the basic religious concepts have to evolve to fundamentally include the shaman as indispensable to the whole nature of God and humans and the relationship of humans to God. I mean, they're going to see to that, right? That they become a very significant focus point, or focal point, in the whole scheme of evolutionary religion. It's going to end up being, slightly humanistic. Just because of them, right? There's going to be a tendency because of the existence of the shamans to draw things from God to man, and feed that that mode, that humanistic mode of trusting in man rather than trusting in God. Okay, so that's enough said up front. Let's see what they say to begin with here.
Paper 90, Shamanism. Medicine men and priests. The evolution of religious observances progressed from placation, avoidance, exorcism, coercion, conciliation, and propitiation to sacrifice, atonement, and redemption. The technique of religious ritual passed from the forms of the primitive cult through fetishes to magic and miracles. And as ritual became more complex in response to man's increasingly complex concept of the supermaterial realms, It was inevitably dominated by medicine men, shamans, and priests.
Okay. So just, you know, notice how that paragraph ends. That sequence again. Medicine men, shamans, and priests. In other words, the word shaman is a word that is intermediary between a pure medicine man concept and a pure priest concept. A shaman is some of each. And some shamans are going to be a little bit more on the medicine man side, and some are going to be a little bit more on the priest side. Yeah. See, same way with the title of the paper. Shamanism is about medicine men and priests. And the collective kind of designation is shaman. And then just the fact that, you know, it doesn't say, the title isn't shamans, medicine men and priests. It's shamanism. That's what I was referring to a minute ago. Right. They, you know, become a complete lifestyle solution in the religious sphere. You know, they become a very dominant, everything orbits about them influence. Okay, so very, very important to consider this, how the various schemes in religiosity have been taken off on tangents in order for the scheme to support the desires, you know, the selfish desires of shamans. You know, taken all the way into modern times with the highest of high priests, and it's still there. Okay, so then the other thing is, you know, just again, kind of what I was just saying, we've gone through all of these concepts. Like they were saying, it's progressed from placation, avoidance, exorcism, coercion, conciliation, and propitiation to sacrifice, atonement, and redemption. All these concepts we've been talking about. But, you know, these are the individuals who, in very short order, you know, become the orchestrators of all those schemes. And, you know, and then again, you know, they continue on. Some of the other stuff we've talked about, you know, it's passed from the forms of the primitive cult through fetishes to magic and miracles, reminding you of all this, all the ground we've covered. And, you know, we'll see right up front, you know, they'll give you that contrast of, what we're talking about is not magic, it's miracle. Right, as if you give the exact same thing a different name, it's a different thing. And then the key thing toward the end there, that, you know, every profession, or maybe we should say, every group of individuals who desire to establish a profession where only professionals can deal with it, right? You got to call the professional. Right? The key to that is you've got to make sure that sphere of human activity is complex to the point that the run-of-the-mill individual just, you know, their eyes glaze over, and they throw up their hands. Say, you know, this is no way. I can't deal with this. I need a professional. And I know they're going to charge me an arm and a leg, but I need a professional. Okay.
More than I need the arm or the leg.
More than I need the arm and the leg. Yes. All right. So that, you know, it's just the usual scheme. There are a number of reasons why things get complicated. As we've talked about, just our desire to put wheels in with wheels of our schemes, you know, drives things more complicated. But again, it would never get as complicated as it does without these individuals involved. In this case, it's the shamans. All right.
In the advancing concepts of primitive man, the spirit world was eventually regarded as being unresponsive to the ordinary mortal. Only the exceptional among humans could catch the ear of the gods. Only the extraordinary man or woman would be heard by the spirits. Religion thus enters upon a new phase, a stage wherein it gradually becomes second-handed. Always does a medicine man, a shaman, or a priest intervene between the religionist and the object of worship. And today, most Urantia systems of organized religious belief are passing through this level of evolutionary development.
We can only hope that they're actually still passing through, and that we haven't spun up our spiritual nature so much now, allowing us to existentialize things all the more than we ever could, so that evolution maybe can't deal with it in any sort of progressing way, you know, and something has to just blow up and kind of reset, right? Remember, that's fundamentally what's in play. Is there going to be an interregnum? You know, have we so gripped things, unfortunately, with our free will, existentialized them, that you, you know, we fundamentally, evolution can't move things forward now. They said it in a hopeful mode there. let's hope that we are just passing through, and we don't have to have a collapse of everything to make things movable again. But okay, so the main part of the paragraph. See how it, there's everything kind of conspires together to make it. Shamans are indispensable. It's super complicated, and the more I think about God or the spirits, the fancier they become. I mean, the run-of-the-mill person is not going to be able to interact with something that fancy. There's that basic logical sense that, two things that are vertically separated, you can, they just pass over and under each other. They get that. They logically that if there's going to be an interaction, there has to be some commonality. They have to be seen on the same eye level, in some way. And so even the primitives have that much of a logical consciousness. And so they start trying to figure out, who's the fanciest? Okay, and as I point out all the time, no one has the philosophic recognition of three elements, matter, mind, and spirit. Right? At best, they have matter and mind. And so inescapably, you're going to, for the very, very primitive person, you're going to look for, quote unquote, fancy matter, someone whose body is abnormal in some way, and hence fancy, in the way you rationalize it. And then as we get more sophisticated and the more it evolves from a religion of matter to a religion of mind, it's inescapably going to be these fancy people are going to be people with fancy mind, some sort of abnormal mental activity. And we're still basically there, right? Because we don't have the three elements. We don't have genuine spirit. So everyone's concept is based upon abnormality of mind is spiritual. And the more abnormal, the more spiritual. And so the most abnormal is going to be the shaman. And so it that's how all that got started way, way back. And then like they said there in the middle of that paragraph, religion thus enters upon a new phase, a stage wherein it gradually becomes second-handed. So, before that point, you definitely needed to put quotes around the word religion. Because consciously it's not genuine, you know, religion. Well, so here's an example of, well, now it's worse. I mean, this is yet another reason why it's not genuine religion, because if it's not fundamentally an individual phenomenon, it can't be religion. There is no such thing as secondhand religion, group religion. Religion is personal spiritual experience. It's absolutely individual. So, this is an interesting sort of inescapable development in the process, that it appears that there's no way around it getting technically less true before it will eventually become true religion. The shamans are just going to really complicate this. And it's going to take a long time for people to finally transcend their influence and all of the, like I said, the whole theological scheme that gets rationalized around them, right, in order to fundamentally get to the concept of genuine religion. Okay, so that's, everyone should go, sigh. Okay, we're all going to have to take a long-term view here. This is, as usual, the progressing in spite of yourself phase is very convoluted, and often, you know, it's two steps back and one step forward, and it's a very messy process. All right, what else do they give us as a preface here?
Evolutionary religion is born of a simple and all-powerful fear, the fear with which surges through the human mind when confronted with the unknown, the inexplicable, and the incomprehensible. Religion eventually achieves the profoundly simple realization of an all-powerful love, the love which sweeps irresistibly through the human soul when awakened to the conception of the limitless affection of the Universal Father for the sons of the universe. But in between the beginning and the consummation of religious evolution, there intervene the long ages of the shamans, who presume to stand between man and God as intermediaries, interpreters, and intercessors.
Okay, so the first thing you got to do is kind of chuckle at the author of this paper, thinking, okay, the point I want to make is that they were thought of as intermediaries, interpreters, and intercessors. Enter, right? I know. I'll set up a paragraph that talks about the beginning of evolution of religion and the end of evolution of religion and put them in the middle as inter. This is kind of a fun paragraph construct. Because, you're reading, it's like, wow, we're kind of going big scale here, but the whole point is to be able to say that, notice what they said there, they're intervene the long ages of the shamans. Yeah, literally, not only are they intervening between the beginning and the end of the evolution, they're everywhere in the middle. But that's fundamentally what they become, that second-handed comment. You've stuck this blockage, let's be generous, filter in between you and God. Okay? Like I was saying before, okay, technically that means you can't relate to the Universal Father now. Because there has to be nothing in between you and the Father in order for there to be a relationship. Because it's a one-to-one. It's not a one-to-two. Right? Or two-to-one. And it's one-to-one, period. So it fundamentally means that there can't be, you can't, no matter how much you try to reach through a shaman or a priest to get to God, you can't. You have to get everything out of the conduit between you and the Father. Yep.
Well, I presume it's like this on every inhabited planet.
Yeah.
So there must be something that's indispensable about this process.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, again, we're kind of in the same boat we were in all the other things. It's like, well, okay, they're going to have taboos and fetishes, so I guess there must be something indispensable about this to the process. And because, you know, it seems like this must happen on every world. And so that's one of the things we're looking for, you know. As we start, continue reading, we want to be kind of keeping our eye out for, well, okay, so what's the positives here? I'm seeing lots of negatives, like I was saying. This seems to make it, you know, take us backward and not forward, make this all the more difficult to eventually break through and get to the goal of the evolution of religion. So what's the deal here? Well, let's see if we can find out. And you know, just then also, notice that they're not just saying something general about them being in between, but you know, giving you these three different modes. I mean, intermediary, interpreter, intercessor, you know. So anyway, you know, there's going to be it's just telling you up front that this is going to get complicated. There's all sorts of in-between modes. Maybe it's just literally there's no way for you to get to God except through the priest, you know, sort of just the immediacy of intermediary. But then there's the issue of, okay, now that, you know, that the two of you are supposedly plugged into each other through the priest, but you can't understand each other, so the priest has to interpret. You know, and then there's the whole issue of the priest needing to intercede on your behalf or whatever. Okay, so all these different complications. The other thing that was kind of fun is at the beginning there, another sequence. Evolutionary religion is born of a simple and all-powerful fear, the fear which surges through the human mind when confronted with the unknown, the inexplicable, and the incomprehensible. That's kind of a fun one to think about, too, the difference between those. You know, and remember, it's kind of building to that incomprehensible. That's, you know, in other words, you can't wrap your mind around it. So the more holistic engagement of it, as opposed to just kind of a linear rational, as it being inexplicable, you know, or just straightforward, you know, unknown, in the simplest, you know, kind of mode there. So that's kind of fun. They love to give you a sequence like that or a pair that contrast, like words that you tend to think of as synonyms. They'll give you both of them and challenge you to reflect on what the difference is between the two. That's one of the sort of, you know, a lot of times it might even be a bit beside the immediate point of what they're talking about. Not, you know, it's not essential to the immediate truth at hand. But throughout the book, they're trying to train your mind so that it can be a mind that could get truth of any flavor, you know, at any point in the book. It requires you developing a precision that you may not have. You know, the circumstances of your life may not have developed that skill in you, and you need to work on that skill. So they're constantly doing little things like that, just, you know, little asides, basically, like I said, they are a lot of times, just to get you to try to reflect. You know, primitive man only thought when he was hungry. Okay, you know, you need to have a full stomach so that you can think well, but you got to be able to really think to engage this book. Okay, so you can't be in that natural mode, and they're trying to just train you by doing things like that. That's why I belabored that at that point a little bit. It's just you know, to remind you yet again to always be, you know, take the time. When you see something, you know, take the time and see if you can sort it out, figure out what the difference is. It will, after a few years of working on that, you'll notice an improvement in your ability to think well. Okay, what do they say here in the first section?
Section 1, the first shamans, the medicine men. The shaman was the ranking medicine man, the ceremonial fetish man, and the focus personality for all the practices of evolutionary religion. In many groups, the shaman outranked the war chief, marking the beginning of the church domination of the state. The shaman sometimes functioned as a priest and even as a priest king. Some of the later tribes had both the earlier shaman medicine men, seers, and the later appearing shaman priests. And in many cases, the office of shaman became hereditary.
Okay, so you can see they're definitely speaking to that. On the one hand, you have medicine man, and on the other hand, you have priest. And even, you know, as I said at the beginning, you know, you begin to develop a specialization. This shaman is a little bit more of a medicine man shaman. This shaman's a little bit more of a priest shaman. You know, or shaman priest, shaman medicine man, as they're saying it there. Yeah, and then not to mention the little parenthetical on the shaman medicine man, seer. Yeah, remember that when we're talking medicine, quote unquote, there may not be any sort of direct attempt to engage the physicality of the body with some physicality, be it drug or, you know, manipulation with the hands or whatever. You know, it may be very hands-off, no substances, but just the full woo-woo treatment. Okay, you know, so the seer sees, you know, blah, blah, blah. Okay. But again, if everyone believes what's going on, it may be effective. Yeah, fervently believes. Okay, the other things, you know, notice that they're reminding you that, not to forget about what we focused on when we were talking about fetishism. Obviously, this is going to be a fetish individual. You know, the fact that you know that we're looking for someone abnormal, right, you know, just like we've talked about before, there's no surer sign that someone is inspirited or possessed or whatever than some abnormality, you know. So goes the historical thinking about such things. You know, I told you up front that they were going to be this focal point. So, yeah, a focus personality, just like I said. And then that whole bit of, you know, they'll explain this a little bit more in a minute. These individuals begin to wield great power. So here's yet another issue you can see. Because we've got these shamans, the whole issue of the separation of church and state is going to be kind of, without them, there probably would be a lot of natural evolution that would get that separated, but they're going to mess that up and greatly delay our ability to separate church and state, because they're going to become very politically powerful. So there's that whole complication. You know, that final statement, you know, we know that when you set up, you know, especially historically, when you set up a profession, there is a very strong tendency for this profession to become hereditary, right? And the son does what the father did, you know, or whatever. You know, in this case, you're going to have lots of women involved, you know, so the daughter, you know, definitely do what the mother did. All right, let's keep going.
Since in olden times anything abnormal was ascribed to spirit possession, any striking mental or physical abnormality constituted qualification for being a medicine man. Many of these men were epileptic, many of the women hysteric, and these two types accounted for a good deal of ancient inspiration as well as spirit and devil possession. Quite a few of these earliest of priests were of a class which has since been denominated paranoid.
Okay. So, I already said a lot of those things. Obviously, it, in the most primitive sense, the physical abnormality would be focused on. I mean, you know, you were worshiping a rock to begin with because it was abnormal, right? And those sorts of things, like we saw. So it starts very religion of matter, but it doesn't take long, and you get basically in the mode that we're still in, where it's the mental abnormality that is the key, and there's a reason why if anyone puts themselves forward as any kind of a religious group or movement, you're going to attract lots and lots of paranoid individuals, like they're saying. Everyone has always thought of that as religious. You know, there's nothing more abnormal than some full-on psychotic, you know, mind. Obviously not just paranoid, but, you know, bring in schizophrenic and whatnot, you know, as well. So, you know, no one who tries to put themselves forward as a religious group or movement should be surprised if they end up with lots of paranoid individuals in their ranks, for instance. Right, it's inescapable. And, you know, even in the, you know, once you have psychology really getting going in the 20th century, it doesn't change the fact that the paranoid individual will think of themselves as spiritual or religious. You know, even if those around them are thinking, no, they're just paranoid, right? Because you've been trained by 20th century psychology. That they're going to naturally rationalize themselves that way, and it's their kind of just. As we're seeing here, I mean, it developed naturally. People got into that mode. And then once you are in that mode, you know, those, you know, a current paranoid individual feels like they're just striking step with the long history of the fact of religiosity. And so nature and nurture, you know, combine to make this just an inescapable problem that you're going to deal with, you know, with paranoid individuals. And, you can kind of imagine where this might go next as they talk about it. If you just think for a second about the details of a paranoid individual. Okay, so extreme suspiciousness, delusions of grandeur, delusions of persecution. Okay, so you got an individual like that. I wonder if this individual is going to end up being quite the schemer. Right? Right. Obviously, this is going to exacerbate. You know, anytime you give someone a lot of authority, you know, you feed into this selfish scheming, self-aggrandizement sort of phenomenon. But if you start with someone who is fundamentally psychotic, you're going to generate quite an interesting profession. These are going to be the masters of machinations. Okay. So, yeah, that's, you know, don't be surprised if that's what we start reading about, because it's all right there between the lines. And then the other details there, and notice that, you know, they mentioned what I was alluding to earlier as well. You not only have kind of the more abstract inspiration concept, right? Accounted for a good deal of ancient inspiration, you know, without the quotes that are technically there, right? As well as spirit and devil possession. Even if you don't kind of go that into that full kind of literally overt possession way of thinking about it. At the very least, you have that refinement of it, that they're ingenious, you know, they're inspirited, whatever. And you've got, you know, notice that you have a kind of an immediate physiological differentiating in this profession, you know, that they're pointing out. Many of these men were epileptic, many of the women hysteric. So some of the genetic weaknesses that humans have, of course, have some sex differential to them, right? In the way that because the mind is attuned so differently for men and women, you're going to naturally get kind of different flavors of mental abnormality, you know, maybe stemming from kind of similar genetic defects, deficiencies. Okay, but because of the difference of the mind attunement between men and women, you get a different manifestation. So you can just imagine, you know, eventually we're going to figure out the quote unquote physics of this, you know, and that women are going to be naturally specialized in certain areas, you know, that their mental abnormality is, you know, is rationalized as being, you know, precisely effective in this area and that area, but not at that area over there, you know, et cetera. I mean, they're going to develop all that complexity like that. Not to mention kind of the medical thing between the lines about, many of the men were epileptic on the one hand and women hysterical on the other, and exactly what the physical issues are with hysteria and epilepsy and stuff, you know, you could get into that as well, obviously, because of that statement.
Wasn't this the same class of individuals that used to be relegated to the happy hunting ground?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can imagine that before you develop this scheme, you know, these people would be eliminated from the gene pool. So now we're going to have this has a biologic consequence too, all right? That these people are going to be procreating. Yeah, so no wonder we have so, you know, many genetic issues. This would just add to it. All right, let's see what else they've got here.
While they may have practiced deception in minor matters, the great majority of the shamans believed in the fact of their spirit possession. Women who were able to throw themselves into a trance or a cataleptic fit became powerful shamanesses. Later, such women became prophets and spirit mediums. Their cataleptic trances usually involved alleged communications with the ghosts of the dead. Many female shamans were also professional dancers.
You got to love the little twist on it at the end there, because you know, you can only make so much money as a shamanist, so you got to augment your income. But you know, it's not just the simpleness of that, of them as a dancer. You know, think about how much more compelling it would be, you know, if it's not just the genetic attraction of a male for the female, but if you add the whole mysteriousness of, you know, if she's a shamaness, I mean, you're already kind of thinking that the feminine wild thing, the womanly wild things, is, you know, is because she's inspirited. But you know, you're going to augment that. She's going to be all the more just, you know, transcendently exciting, because you know, you think, you know, she's this extensive inspirited phenomenon. Okay, It's just going to amplify her charms because of that. So, going to make a lot of money as a dancer. You know, the royalty will pay any price to be entertained by such. And, you know, notice that they are, they're pointing out that very quickly there's a vast domain of professional potential for women that's being generated here in a way that it isn't for men. You know, and again, you can kind of just reflect on it a little bit. You can immediately feel it's like, you know, I'll bet it has a lot to do with the lack of, you know, kind of innate linearity. The female's more place than direction. The fact that she isn't sort of just charging along a line. The fact that she has a mind that is more tends to kind of just be in a spot and kind of fold back on itself and whatnot. That probably fosters a mind being able to get into these trance states and, you know, catalepsy and whatnot. Yep.
What is catalepsy?
Well, I mean, it's just, it literally means that you're being, you know, taken down or seized down. It's just like with epilepsy. I mean, you have these various modes of seizure, quasi unconsciousness, trance like states. You know, all the different flavors of this. Cataleptic fit is, you go into a very profound trance sort of state, and your body gets rigid, and so you're obviously all these various states. The kata part of that is important, the down part of that. All these various states are achieved by kind of forcing the mind down away from the upper domain and its objective over control. Okay, I mean, in order for the mind to take on all sorts of abnormal things. I mean, remember, you have a normal mind not because that just happens automatically. I mean, basically, you have a normal mind because of your encirclement in the Holy Spirit and the frame that it puts around your mind. It makes you sane. Okay, once you have all seven adjutants, if you don't have a solid cosmic frame put around that mind, it's not going to be stable long term. And so most of the fancy mind, the weird behavior and whatnot, has to do with what certain drugs do and what, almost all this sort of stuff is in one way or another getting it so that you have an untethered lower domain. To some degree, and a less over-controlled lower domain. All the psychotic phenomena are predicated. You have to minimize or effectively eliminate the over-control of the upper domain in order to make your mind function like that, right? In those abnormal states. In humans. Not only can, may it have tendencies to get thrown down like this, right? We quickly figured out ways to drive our minds into this state. They're pointing out here, where are those women who were able to throw themselves into a trance. So you develop this skill of kind of severing your cosmic over control, and having your mind go much more liquid and loosey-goosey. Okay. And then everyone can go, ooh, they're possessed or whatever. we all know, that there are expressions that basically speak to this recognition that this mind seems to be without a frame around it, and you know, get a grip on yourself, and, you know, they've come unhinged, right, you know, or whatever, right? I mean, all these various expressions that we have, right, that, you know, are recognizing that that's the problem, that there isn't the bounding frame around the mind like there's supposed to be. And it's just and it's off the rails. Whatever. It's just squirting off, you know, in random directions, doing all sorts of very weird things when it does that. You know, these asymmetric states of mind. All right. And the other thing that I you know, you see here specifically that I was hinting at, you know, you're going to develop all these specific things. You know, there became powerful shamanesses, and then later, such women became prophets and spirit mediums. And so, you know, and getting more specialized and getting ever more abstract and complicated concepts about what's going on and what they can do, and so on. You know, obviously, if they're you know, if you really bring in, like they're saying, their communications with the ghosts of the dead, if you bring in a lot of very definitive notion of relationship to the dead, that's the whole necromancer concept, right? You know, divination of the dead. Okay, so all that stuff's coming into play. All right?
But not all shamans were self-deceived. Many were shrewd and able tricksters. As the profession developed, a novice was required to serve an apprenticeship of 10 years of hardship and self-denial to qualify as a medicine man. The shamans developed a professional mode of dress and affected a mysterious conduct. They frequently employed drugs to induce certain physical states which would impress and mystify the tribesmen. Sleight of hand feats were regarded as supernatural by the common folk, and ventriloquism was first used by shrewd priests. Many of the olden shamans unwittingly stumbled onto hypnotism. Others induced auto-hypnosis by prolonged staring at their navels.
Here we go, the staring at your belly button. in other words, you know, intense introspection, right, can get you, you know, kind of in this disconnected tail chasing state of mind, right? Okay, before we get into some of those details there about how the tricks of the trade, as it were, you know, think about what we didn't talk about in the preceding paragraph and what they're amplifying here. You know, it's because you have a firm belief by everyone in the reality of what we're talking about here. You know, it obviously at least can't begin in full-on deception. You know, there's going to be a lot of sincere individuals. Okay? And yeah, like they said, you know, they may have practiced deception in minor matters, right? Just to kind of, you know, like you add a little twist to the, you know, the fish story when you tell it, right? You know, I mean, everyone, you know, embellishes a little bit, okay? But they were fundamentally genuine, at least, you know, majority to begin with. But, you know, as we read further, we'll see there's going to be influences brought to bear on this profession where over time it basically becomes a wholly deceitful profession. Kind of like the tendency in politics. Right? Where basically every single word that comes out of their mouth is deceit. Right? That's the profession. And it's a, you know, it's a time-honored, cherished profession. And the more clever you are at your deceit, the more you're lauded, you know, amongst your fellow professionals as being exceptional. Give that person an award. No one can be deceitful like they can. So you've got that, but let's make sure we understand, because we're going to talk about that deceit a lot. It didn't start out that way, right? But unlike the superstitious concepts that we've been talking about, that are just concepts. When you're talking about humans, there's this insidious, incessant clamoring, right, that gets a hold of the idea and twists it around. Right? It can't stay in that kind of innocent, superstitious state, like just a abstract concept can just stay its superstitious, sameness, ad nauseum. The humans are going to twist this around very quickly. Okay, so that's a difference that we haven't seen. Okay, and then like they're talking about, they come up with all these things. You stumble upon throwing your voice, like, ooh, I could make it seem like God was talking from over there in the temple, and all that stuff gets going. So obviously current magicians all are benefiting from what these shamans figured out in the day. Like they're saying, sleight of hand and all that sort of stuff was all developed by the shamans to wow the masses. And hypnotism, all these things. And then in the middle there, I wanted to comment, because this is, no matter how much you kind of move away from primitive shamanistic practices, people who want to be seen as any kind of a religious leader still, you have to always wonder how much is witting and how much is unwitting, but get into this mode. Like they're saying there, the shamans developed a professional mode of dress and affected a mysterious conduct. That affectation thing, right, is, it's just so overt. I mean, they all kind of, like I say, at least unconsciously know that no one is going to accept them as a valid religious leader. Because they know they're just going to kind of declare themselves to be a religious leader. No one's going to accept this self-declaration unless they wear the proper garb and speak and move in that certain way. Right? The whole affectation scheme. Right? If you wear all white garments, you are a religious leader. Everyone knows it. And will immediately just, do whatever you tell them because you're wearing white robes. It's very powerful stuff because it has such a long tradition. And not to mention, it obviously must have some natural resonance. That's why the shamans, figured it out. But it now has almost a million years of tradition to it where it makes it almost impossible for humans to not be affected by the affectations. You have to always just kind of roll your eyes when you see that. We probably can all, as long as I'm thinking about it, we probably all can remember, if you go back to the Marantxa Life paper, the classic line in there. Let's see, where is that one? Can I find it just off the top of my head? I didn't think to look this one up in advance. Remember the one in there about the affectations? Number 15. Affectation is the ridiculous effort of the ignorant to appear wise, the attempt of the barren soul to appear rich. All right, so doesn't really beat around the bush, fairly direct statement. So again, we see, this is just very problematic. We're, you set up this whole affectation scheme, and just like it's saying there, this is going to, you're going to end up having the most barren individuals being, accepted as the religious leaders. The most empty souls will be deemed to be the most rich souls because of this. So, yeah, it seems like the shamans are going to make this hopeless. How is mankind ever going to go forward? Everything about them is so aggressively 180 degrees from where you would like this to evolve. So, boy, we're still looking. It's like, so what's the positive thing here? Why does this, why is the system set up so this could happen? We're kind of looking for that, and we're more and more desperately looking for it because it looks pretty grim. Right? Not to mention, of course, the other thing you have in there. I mean, drugs are an intriguing curiosity for primitive humans to begin with, but then you really get it all mystified, by the shamans here. Then it becomes, it's all about spiritual experiences, right, and everything. They're the ones that made that the accepted assumption that that's what drugs do. All right.
While many resorted to these tricks and deceptions, their reputation as a class, after all, stood on apparent achievement. When a shaman failed in his undertakings, if he could not advance a plausible alibi, he was either demoted or killed. Thus, the honest shamans early perished. Only the shrewd actors survived.
There it is. Told you it was coming in short order. Yeah, so it starts out innocent, right, and sincere. But it quickly, there's a very harsh filter that eliminates all those people. And so, when all is said and done, you basically have nothing but the most conniving, utterly deceptive individuals are populating this profession. Because anyone else, that isn't quick on their feet when their weather prediction or whatever doesn't pan out, all right, off with their head. And so you can imagine also just there would be a whole sort of a standard rationalization scheme that would quickly develop, where they know what, if it doesn't go as they predicted, what you can say, and almost always, turns things around for you with the populace. So, again, all of these techniques, those are eventually going to be adopted by politicians, right? When nothing that they promised comes to pass, they know the shaman responses, right? They know that if they respond to it in this way, everyone quickly, totally is not mad at them anymore, and actually they become a sympathetic figure, and, they just turn it right around, and everyone is just led by their nose rings. All of these clever techniques for leading people by their nose rings is developed by these shamans and handed off to politicians. Okay.
That's why
Okay, so just all this stuff is going on between the lines here. They, you know, this again, like I said, wow, this seems nothing but negative. All right, so we're really looking for what's the positive here. Let's see. Anything else there? We've kind of talked about that a lot already. So let's keep going.
It was shamanism that took the exclusive direction of tribal affairs out of the hands of the old and the strong and lodged it in the hands of the shrewd, the clever, and the farsighted.
Okay. So you have an interesting development here. You remember how there was a very early tendency to to have the leadership of the tribe be, you know, initially in some group of the elder wise individuals, you know, and well, that seemed like a very positive thing, you know, to uplift wisdom, but you know, the wise group, despite that wisdom wasn't very effective, like the single leader, you know, chief, king, you know, handling military issues. So that tended to, you know, get us away from that initial hopeful sign of that elderly wisdom concept. Here we see another way that it was. So both the chiefs and the shamans coming into existence tend to negate that initial group wisdom leadership concept, which seems sad. But, you know, and the, you know, we've talked about the chief thing. It was very, very important to develop that concept because, you know, you need the effectiveness of the singular commander in chief, the singular chief executive, right? I mean, there's not a team of 100 creator sons that lead a local universe. There's one creator son that leads a local universe. Okay, and here, so what do we see here? Well, we see that, they're ripping the power, not only out of the old, but also, like we saw, I mean, they became so powerful that even the strong man, the chief, is starting to get subjugated by this. But get lodged in the hands of the shrewd, the clever, and the farsighted. Okay, well, the clever part, okay, you just got these really smart people that can, you know, rationalize anything and dance circles around everyone. You know, I don't know. But the shrewd and the farsighted. Okay, by shrewd, you know, even if that's being in a negative mode, right, their shrewdness is all this deception. Remember that to be shrewd, you have to be bringing in some insight. Not just raw horsepower cleverness, but some insight. And then farsighted. So, see, you're kind of backing into the insight and the foresight, and then you'll eventually add in the wisdom so that you have wisdom, insight, and foresight. So here's the first sign that maybe it's not all bad. To have something where, you know, only if you have a little bit better insight and foresight, you know, will you live. Okay, kind of curiously fosters those forward. And that's, you know, I mean, obviously this is often just what, you know, everyone else is, they're functioning so animal-like, they're in the moment. You just have some guy that can kind of think a couple chess moves ahead of everyone else, and you know, and he's just, you know, he's always going to come out, you know, because you know they're just thinking one move ahead, and he's thinking five moves ahead, and so you know, he doesn't get executed. You know, he's got plan B, plan C, plan D already in the can. Okay, and even though initially it's all in this self-serving negative mode, it nonetheless is developing that, you know, in some leader individuals. So you're going, well, maybe this is beginnings of something with shades of positiveness to it here.
And if he's shrewd and clever enough, he's got what no one else has in this time, is a little bit of leisure to actually think up these schemes. Nobody else has the time. They're faced with hard reality.
Yeah, not only will he have leisure because of, you know, his shrewdness, cleverness, whatnot, but as we're about to see, you know, he's going to have vast wealth and stuff. And so, yeah, so that also, you can already read between the lines, that giving some leisure, you know, is going to allow for some reflective thinking. You know, if they're not trying to manipulate everyone around them, and they're just, it's just them in their hut or whatever, for a little while, you know, they might actually just do some more straightforward reflective thinking, right? And start to make some recognitions about some things. Yeah. Right. So yeah, we're seeing how, you know, it's the positiveness is always, you back into the positiveness, you know, back in these primitive times. No one is ever, you know, going face first into this stuff. You're always backing into it. But that's what we're looking for, is how does this, you know, how do we back into positive things despite all of the negative upfront stuff? All right. Let's get into some of the details here now then.
Section 2, shamanistic practices. Spirit conjuring was a very precise and highly complicated procedure, comparable to present-day church rituals conducted in an ancient tongue. The human race very early sought for superhuman help, for revelation, and men believed that the shaman actually received such revelations. While the shamans utilized the great power of suggestion in their work, it was almost invariably negative suggestion. Only in very recent times has the technique of positive suggestion been employed. In the early development of their profession, the shamans began to specialize in such vocations as rainmaking, disease healing, and crime detecting. To heal diseases was not, however, the chief function of a shamanic medicine man. It was rather to know and to control the hazards of living.
Yeah, that's shamanic is the way you say that one, when you actually can, you know, change the way the vowel is to, and okay, so we're seeing all that specialization that I was talking about before, you know, developing. But you know, let's go back to the beginning of the paragraph and see what we have here. So, right up front, okay, spirit conjuring was a very precise and highly complicated procedure, comparable to present-day church rituals conducted in an ancient tongue. Okay, so here again, you're seeing between the lines, very precise and highly complicated, right? That's again feeding into the kind of mind that can be brought to a tighter focus so that you can eventually have science. And so that's being backed into. Like they're pointing out, I mean, it may, you know, even a modern church ritual, you know, a present-day church ritual conducted in an ancient tongue, you know, like Latin, okay? I mean, even if objectively it's all mumbo jumbo woo woo superstition and whatnot doesn't mean anything really. You know, it's not any old person that has a sophisticated enough mind to do that. Okay, so you know you are unwittingly honoring, you know, some better minds. It's just, you know, it'd be wonderful at some point if those better minds had something better to focus on, right? You know, imagine what some of these great minds could do with their life if they didn't spend their whole life figuring out the details of non-existent objects like black holes. I mean, right. But nonetheless, okay, we, you know, we're encouraging someone to develop that precise scientific-like mind, and we're honoring that. So others attempt to, you know, imitate that person's achievements, and eventually, you know, we'll have something worth thinking about for those individuals. But you know, you need both. You need something worthy of thinking about, and you need someone who can think about such worthy things. Yeah. Okay, so you're backing into that more precise mind again. Remember, we saw, you know, backing into that issue before, you know, some of the stuff we've run across. Notice how they italicized Revelation in there. Right? The human race very early sought for superhuman help for Revelation. That's reminding you of the preconceived opinion, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices tied to the word revelation. You know, when you just say the Urantia book is a revelation to someone, you know, they're going to have all sorts of curious thoughts attached to that word. You probably, you know, to begin with, had all kinds of curious thoughts attached to that word. I hope that, you know, you've evolved, you know, and have come to a better recognition of what it means to talk about revelators, you know, writing this book, as opposed to historically, you know, what a quote unquote revelator was, you know, a shaman. So they're giving you that little reminder in there. Notice there, you know, they mentioned all the things of figuring out sleight of hand and ventriloquism and all sorts. You know, the whole bit about they're becoming, you know, the original psychologists too. All right, they're starting to really figure out, like I was saying, you know, what you can say in response that people have irresistible, you know, tendency to go with, and all those all those things that marketers, you know now, you know, that psychologists figured out, and the shamans developed a lot of that understanding long ago, long before modern psychology, the power of suggestion, right? like they were saying there. You know, matter of fact, the great power, right, of suggestion. All right, you can wield, you know, when people are helpless victims of antecedent causation, right, they're very suggestive. And you know, and of course it's all gonna start out negative. You know, I mean, nothing else. I mean, what this is all about is taboos, and those are the thou shalt nots, right? It's all kind of a negative scheme to begin with. When you think about when they say only in very recent times has the technique of positive suggestion been employed, right? You've got professionals, you know, all over the place, especially relating to businesses and stuff now, right, that practice these skills of positive suggestion. You know, what are they called? Well, yeah, we'll kind of tongue-in-cheek call them gurus. You know, we're going to have a guru come in and give us a talk, right? They're these motivational speakers, right? When I look out in the audience, I see nothing but positive potential. Right? All that power of positive suggestion. Right? Right, that's, you know. So like I said, I mean, there's so many of these things that the shamans figured out and developed into a high art form that are still around, even though the shamans aren't. You know, the politicians are using it, or the motivational speakers are using it, or the literal, you know, Vegas magician is using it, or whatever. Yeah. Right.
Instead of getting killed, you just die on stage.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly. All right, let's see. What else we have there? Let's see here. The last thing. Yeah, just that very last thing. And they were talking about the specialization of things like rainmaking and disease healing and crime detection. To heal diseases was not, however, the chief function of the shamanic medicine man. It was rather to know and to control the hazards of living. So again, see, if they're going to develop that into a sophisticated skill, right, you need insight and foresight. Right, to know and control the hazards of living. You know, everyone else, you know, the hazards just come out of nowhere. They're totally clear. It's like, who could have known that such a thing was going to happen? You know, everyone is saying, well, this guy with a little insight and foresight knows exactly what's going to happen, and he just manipulates the whole situation to his aggrandizement. Okay. Right, so again, just, you know, we already emphasize that. That's, we're backing into developing insight and foresight, even if it's for selfish ends to begin with. And it's eventually a skill that can be directed towards righteousness instead of self-righteousness. Yeah, did you have something?
Well, I was just thinking of hedge fund managers.
Hedge fund managers, yeah. Right, you know, obviously, we could just go on and on. I mean, so many of our professions, the skill in the profession is sort of just the latest evolution of these basic skills that the shamans were developing. Okay. So all of it is, you know, instead of looking at all of these things like marketing or hedge fund managers or whatever, you know, as a negative actuality, you know, don't think about that first. You know, think about it in an evolutionary sense. There's a positive potentiality there. Eventually, there will be goals of civilization that will take these skills and direct them to higher ends. Okay. But the skills need to be there in order to be better directed. God can't steer a parked car. You can't, you can't point nothing in a specific direction, right? You have to have a something first. So these skills have to be spun up in humans first before they can be better directed. Now, obviously, all these things would have begun to be better directed way long ago by the Prince's staff, yeah. Right? But, you know, since we didn't get that guidance, you know, we've had to slowly evolve into better direction. That which revelation, with the first epical revelation, failed to accomplish, evolution, right, is going to eventually achieve through the school of hard knocks or whatever. We'll decide that, you know, it'd be better to direct this skill like that than that very self, you know, centered, self-serving way.
Category of development, the shamanic.
Mm-hmm.
Is that common to all worlds, or is that just?
Yeah, I mean, again, you can tell that it's going to tend to be common to all worlds. There's probably going to be variations, though. Mm-hmm. Of, you know, first of all, you know, it's not going to have as long to develop like it did here because, like, of what I was just saying, on every normal world without a rebellion, prince's staff would, you know, start guiding this to better ends in a shorter length of time. But you know, certainly in the early stages on every world, it would kind of be an evolutionary process with all of its vicissitudes. And then you take a rebellion world, like the neighboring planet. Now, obviously, if there was, like the island continent individuals, you know, that they tell you directly that they didn't have as much of a drive genetically to really get religion, quote unquote. They were kind of getting philosophy first. So you can imagine that there might not have been as runaway shamanic phenomenon amongst them. Now, of course, on some of the other continents on that world, it might have been going, you know, kind of bananas. But so there would be variations. But, you know, there's just no way that humans aren't going to see an opportunity to be a professional. You know, whenever there's a domain of human activity, someone always has the great idea, you know, what that area of interest needs is a professional. You know, and they, you know, work our way into that sphere and, you know, and become its focal point. So, all right. See, I think we got everything there. Yeah, let's keep going.
Ancient black art, both religious and secular, was called white art when practiced by either priests, seers, shamans, or medicine men. The practitioners of the black art were called sorcerers, magicians, wizards, witches, enchanters, necromancers, conjurers, and soothsayers. As time passed, all such purported contact with the supernatural was classified either as witchcraft or shamancraft.
Okay, so the dual spiritism thing is obviously going to come into play with this. Like I said, we're kind of, you know, remember, we're just going over this stuff again and thinking about the shamanic consequences of all these various concepts as they developed. And we already are beginning to see this this use of language to you know, declare a difference that doesn't exist. Right? Oh, no. I'm not a witch. I'm a shaman. It's totally different. 180 degrees, you know. One is black and one is white. Okay. And, you know, so, you know, that stuff is all coming out. You know, so the positive ones, you've got priests and seers and shamans and medicine men. But all those ones, remember that, you know, remember the kind of the blackness thing is if it's not sort of for and sanctioned by the group, but it's a more individual thing, you know, for individual selfish ends and whatnot, that's the black arts. Right, so then you've got the sorcerers, the magicians, the wizards, the witches, the enchanters, the necromancers, the conjurers, and the soothsayers. You know, and we're, and of course, we've already talked about, we've got wizards and witches, we've got the male-female differential. And then, you know, see the fully at the end, you know, once you kind of get away from all of that complication there, all those different specialties, if you will, or whatever, you know, you get more and more to the kind of dichotomy heaven hell, you know, sorts of you know, definitive good bad religious modality, where you've got what in the general quote unquote bad stuff is the witchcraft. And, you know, you just kind of put it all under that umbrella. And the positive stuff is shamancraft. And the degree to which a more sophisticated group of people are leaving behind the concept of the shaman, it's going to be priestcraft. Yeah. And so, you know, and then the priests will want to burden the witches and right and et cetera. So, you know, we all are familiar with endless stories about when everything is really in kind of that simple twofold mode. No one is saying, no, 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 that's not a witch. That's a, you know, that's a necromancer. Or, you know, I mean, you know, right? Yeah, you know, we're very simplistic about it, you know, after a while. Okay.
Witchcraft embraced the magic performed by earlier, irregular, and unrecognized spirits. Shamancraft had to do with miracles performed by regular spirits and recognized gods of the tribe. In later times, the witch became associated with the devil, and thus was the stage set for the many comparatively recent exhibitions of religious intolerance. Witchcraft was a religion with many primitive tribes.
Again, and you know, and we kind of, you know, once we moved forward, we all know that, you know, there was this sort of revalidating of witchcraft, you know, that everyone said, oh, that was all just an arbitrary good, bad thing. You know, and they're pointing, okay, there's some validity to that. You know, what you know, many Christians were denigrating as well, that's, you know, innately bad, it's of the devil, that's witchcraft. Okay, all it is just primitive evolutionary religion. You know, and the difference between the shaman and the wizard is, you know, it's an arbitrary distinction in many ways. Right? But, you know, you notice that the key thing, of course, where they're trying to really poke you hard, if just to make sure you get poked hard enough, they italicize the words. On the one hand, you have what you call magic. Oh, that's bad. That's of the devil. And on the other hand, you have what you call miracles. Oh, that's good. That's of God. You know, that's one of the big challenges. You know, can you rise above the self-satisfaction of that distinction? That, you know, you think you've reached the ends of the evolutionary process when you've differentiated miracle from magic. You know, most people think that they're at that end point, right? And they find the Arantia book and they're stuck there, right? And, you know, even though the Jesus Papers tries mightily to get you to move forward. I mean, it not only tries mightily, but they try very graciously to, you know, say, okay, we're not going to force you to stop using the word miracle. We're going to try to help you think of it more objectively. I mean, you know, there's no miracles in the way you think of miracles as magical. There's absolutely no magic. So the word miracle has no validity in this mode where it's just a difference in name only from the word magic. Okay. But you could use it as a word that indicated that the physics that's going on in the process is not understood. You know, they're willing to let us continue to use the word in that sort of evolutionary step forward like that. Okay. But don't be afraid to just let go of the word all together if you're ready to do that, and just say, well, you know, here, this is, you know, this physics involves the power personality synthesis, you know, that is the supreme type deity that's in Jesus at that point, and, you know, anyway, you know, instead of just saying, well, I can't write down the equations for the power personality synthesis functioning, you know, stuff, you know, so I'm just going to you call it a miracle. You don't have to call it a miracle. You could just say it's this mostly unknown physical process, but you know it's a physical process. And you're just willing to, you know, to let go of the word miracle altogether now.
That changes my mayonnaise to recipe whip.
But, you know, again, we remember, we know why all this stuff developed. It's so natural. It's going, you know, it feels like a corruption of your thoughts about Jesus to think about him scientifically. Because you say, I don't want to think about him scientifically, I want to think about him religiously. Yeah, but see, for you, religious means anti-scientifically. It means magically. It means woo-woo Jesus, right? Yeah, you know, that's the basic problem. If you continue to hold on to the word miracle, you're always going to have a tendency to kind of fuzz out again, and it's just going to be about, I like Jesus because of the feeling he gives me. I don't really think about him logically. I don't recognize how of all human knowledge, which is the word science, that which is of greatest value is to know the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. Right? You don't even notice that that's a statement of his scientific usefulness. But you make it a platitude because you like, as a platitude, you like the way it feels, and therefore you think it's a religious statement. So, all right, let's see here. Did we get everything there? Between the lines there, they knew they wouldn't have to say it overtly. Many comparatively recent exhibitions of religious intolerance. Yeah, there's the witch burning. Of course. All right, keep going.
The shamans were great believers in the mission of chance as revelatory of the will of the spirits. They frequently cast lots to arrive at decisions. Modern survivals of this proclivity for casting lots are illustrated not only in the many games of chance, but also in the well-known counting out rhymes. Once the person counted out must die. Now he is only it in some childish game. That which was serious business to primitive man has survived as a diversion of the modern child.
Eeny, meeny, miny, mo.
loves me
not. Right. And if you're a potential shaman in ancient times, and you know that when you've got an argument with your friend, and you're going to ask his mom to solve it by doing eeny, meeny, miny, mo, you think it out in advance and then suggest to her that she start with him.
Yeah.
Right?
Because they can't count.
Because they haven't counted out and you have. You know, and if it starts with him, it's going to end with you and yeah. You win.
Yeah.
Right? See, that, I mean, literally, you know, if it's not obvious, I figured that out as a young boy, right? That, you know, a little bit of clever insight, foresight stuff, right, that the shaman was doing. Because the run-of-the-mill individual, right, the friend and the mom, weren't even thinking about that, right? You use a little power suggestion. You know, you get that even as a little kid. It's easy to just suggest that. And you can be very innocent about it, right? You can be totally deceptive, fly under everyone's radar. That's, you know, this should have been, you know, something like that was probably, you know, should have been an experience for you at some point in your life. You know, where if you are kind of potential shaman. If you have just a little bit of insight and stuff, right? So obviously the whole point is for someone like me to early on have guidance from parents to direct that to less, you know, selfish ends.
Start from left to right so you could position yourself in that place. Or
right.
Have your friend position then.
Right. However, right, you think the scheme out, right, get it all figured out and just prearrange things so that it comes out your way.
Be like, gracious and let them start with them.
Yes. Oh, no, don't start with me. Start with. Right. Well, whatever it takes. And that, you know. If you just think about, you know, how you thought about stuff like that as a little kid, you'll understand what the, you know, what they're talking about, the shamans. It'll make what they just said less abstract about what the shamans are doing. It just takes a little bit, right, to be several steps ahead of the, you know, the run-of-the-mill person that's just kind of totally in the moment, you know, in the immediacies of self-gratification and stuff. Let's see here. What else do we have there? Let's see. Yeah, well, we, you know, we've talked a lot about the whole casting lots thing and stuff, you know, with chance. But yeah, the one interesting point, you can think about this in other ways too. How things that were deadly, literally deadly serious one time with adults, become, you know, just silly trivialities with children going forward, like ring around the rosy, right? Things like that. You know, that's an interesting tendency that, when the adults have totally let go of it, the children will carry it forward, you know, in some trivial mode. So it's another way that that the essence of something feeds forward in time. And like I was just pointing out, you know, thinking about how you might have thought and schemed when you were a child, you know, it's kind of appropriate because in many ways, those primitive people were just, you know, like little children. So kind of actually, you know, it seemed like it went from adult to children, but really it just stayed with children.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because those children, it still kind of resonates, that sort of mode of thinking still resonates with them. That's the kind of minds that it resonated with to begin with. All right.
The medicine men put great trust in signs and omens, such as, quote, when you hear the sound of a rustling in the tops of the mulberry trees, then shall you bestir yourself, end quote. Very early in the history of the race, the shamans turned their attention to the stars. Primitive astrology was a worldwide belief and practice. Dream interpreting also became widespread. All this was soon followed by the appearance of those temperamental shamanesses who professed to be able to communicate with the spirits of the dead.
Here we go with the women and how they excel in certain areas again. the quote-unquote there is David, King David, you know, supposedly being told by God when to go attack the Philistines. And, you know, just the very fact that this story in the Bible is, you know, David conferring with God, you know, look what they're saying here. Technically, David was conferring with some shaman. You know, and it might not even have been, you know, sometimes, you know, things were back then sort of a literally a shaman, but more of, you know, what the modern Christian would call a witch, right? the unsanctioned, seer or in between person. If you believe in the literalness of that, you don't mention the individual. You're talking to God. God is talking through the person. And so you tell the story as David talking to God. Medicine men put great trust in signs and omens. To take it even further, I mean, the whole bit about the sound of the rustling in the tops of the mulberry trees, if you read the whole story, the idea is that wind going through the leaves and the trees, that's literally God going through the tree, rustling the leaves, going out in advance of David getting out to the Philistines so that God is already present there and is going to see to the death of the Philistines. God is the leader on the white horse. You need to wait until he's in the lead of the army, right? And you follow him, out onto the plain.
Whatever works,
right? And of course, just the very fact that you believe that you've got God on your side, maybe the power of positive suggestion, you've got the confidence and you win because of that, right? And then of course, bringing up astrology and dream interpretation, everyone knows those go right on to the present day, right? And even, things like dream interpretation even get reinforced by the supposed scientists of the psychologists, right? You have to really wonder. It's like, guys, don't you know that's how the whole evolutionary religion thing got started? Ghostland is dreamland, and now you're reinforcing that? I thought we were trying to move away from, the ghost cult. Yeah. But it's so natural that they just unwittingly, reinitiate it.
Okay. Though of ancient origin, the rainmakers, or weather shamans, have persisted right on down through the ages. A severe drought meant death to the early agriculturalists. Weather control was the object of much ancient magic. Civilized man still makes the weather the common topic of conversation. The olden peoples all believed in the power of the shaman as a rainmaker, but it was customary to kill him when he failed, unless he could offer a plausible excuse to account for the failure.
Yeah, they're just doubling down on that statement because, obviously you think about it. Yeah, the whole weather thing, that one's going to quickly get rid of all of the sincere individuals, right? And you're going to have to be a real BS artist, right, to be successful in this game. The amazing thing is, there's always going to be some that love that challenge. They do the risk reward assessment. We're going to talk about the rewards here in a second. The rewards are great. So there's always going to be those that I know I can do it. I'm clever enough. I'm going to take this on. You didn't have to force people to be a weather shaman. Yeah. Again, just think about how we naturally think about the weatherman. People don't think about it, how when they're listening to the weatherman, they have a basic unrecognized assumption in play that they're listening to the weather shaman, right? And that he's prophetically telling you the future. And then just, as they mentioned, just that fact that, how about the weather yesterday, if it's not sports, it's the weather, right?
Yeah.
Again, it's just, like they're saying, this is such a natural sphere that you could become this successful professional in. mean, people are very interested in this stuff. Curiously so, when you think about it. I mean, think about, yeah, it's one thing for agriculturalists to be interested in the weather, but why are most of us so fixated on the weather, right, that you can have a weather channel? Right, there's something really compelling about it.
Owned by IBM.
Right? They're just alluding to wanting you to reflect on that between the lines. It's like, why am I so drawn to that? Why would I have been such a sucker for the weather shaman? I would have given him all of my worldly possessions. Because I just can't help but think about this stuff.
It's called climate.
yeah, not to mention, when we bring in the whole, climate stuff these days. All right, so, weather control is the object of much ancient magic. And, of course, we tried to just transfer that weather control over to science. And anyway, you can see how, we've only read a little bit of this paper, and it's just, these shamans, very significant. I mean, they were the seeds for so much of our whole culture. And the way we think about things and whatnot, it's just, they're a very, very important influence in the history of not just evolutionary religion, but, civilization in general. Okay?
Again and again did the Caesars banish the astrologers, but they invariably returned because of the popular belief in their powers. They could not be driven out, and even in the 16th century after Christ, the directors of Occidental church and state were the patrons of astrology. Thousands of supposedly intelligent people still believe that one may be born under the domination of a lucky or an unlucky star, that the juxtaposition of the heavenly bodies determines the outcome of various terrestrial adventures. Fortune tellers are still patronized by the credulous.
Gee, where did the graciousness go? Whoops. Yeah, one of those rugged passages, where they just give it to you really straight. Supposedly intelligent, credulous. And notice the reference, what's the significance of even in the 16th century after Christ? In other words, right up to the beginning, right before the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment, 17th, 18th, 19th century. So, they're just pointing out that it wasn't until the Enlightenment that you really began to drive this stuff out of not just state, but church. And again, reminding you of how natural it is, how ingrained. You can have all kinds of strongmen try to, force it out of the system, but you can't. I mean, people just will not naturally believe otherwise. It's a very, very natural mode. They're reinforcing there. The Caesars weren't just suggesting, okay? I mean, lots of people were being executed. Still, you couldn't get rid of it. All right.
The Greeks believed in the efficacy of oracular advice. The Chinese used magic as protection against demons. Shamanism flourished in India, and it still openly persists in Central Asia. It is an only recently abandoned practice throughout much of the world.
Yes. Oracles. We all know the oracles of Delphi and all that sort of stuff, right? As they're pointing out, it's only recently abandoned, you know, throughout much of the world, and, you know, you still go to the more backwaters, primitive areas, and you don't have, you know, shamans now called priests. You have shamans, right? You know, and you'll make a religious pilgrimage to Central America or South America or something to, you know, gain the influence or wisdom of a shaman, because, you know, the modern stuff is not doing it for you, and you want to seek that more powerful, more ancient stuff. A lot of money to made by travel agents, you know, setting up trips to visit shamans in Central and South America. So all of this, as everyone knows, is very, 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 very intriguing even to this day. All right?
Ever and anon, true prophets and teachers arose to denounce and expose shamanism. Even the vanishing red men had such a prophet within the past 100 years, the Shawnee Tuskwetawa, who predicted the eclipse of the sun in 1808 and denounced the vices of the white man. Many true teachers have appeared among the various tribes and races all through the long ages of evolutionary history, and they will ever continue to appear to challenge the shamans or priests of any age who oppose general education and attempt to thwart scientific progress.
Okay, so first of all, we have to deal, you know, this is one of the classic paragraphs. You know, so if you go to the original text, you've got two typos in the original text. His name is Tenskwatawa, and the year is 1806. The eclipse was in 1806. So that's a spot that, you know, you have to correct a couple typos there, you know, which is easy to do because it's a very, 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 very famous incident. Not only, you know, relative to Tenskwatawa and Tecumseh, but that eclipse was very significant. That's the eclipse when the scientists were observing it, where they first named the corona. You know, that you can only see once you cover up the photosphere with the moon, you know, then you can see that very thin outer atmosphere of the sun that's called the corona. That's when it got that name. So the typos aside, okay, the first thing that, you know, you see that they're doing this aside, we're ensconced in these shamans and all of their deceit and all this sort of stuff. Was saying, okay, but that doesn't mean there weren't occasionally true prophets and teachers. For instance, there were many significant American Indian, you know, Amerind religious leaders that were called prophets in their day. But they're saying there was one that was a genuine prophet. Tenskwatawa was being engaged by someone. I don't know who. But they're telling you he was genuinely being influenced. They're pointing out that having people that are genuinely engaged is an important part of planetary governments guiding the evolution on every world. Okay. Like they're saying here, many true teachers have appeared among the various tribes and races all through the long ages of evolutionary history, and they will ever continue to appear. I see, it's the way they say that. You know, it's not just something special because of rebellion and default on this planet or something like that. Okay. On this world, for instance, long after all that stuff is in the rearview mirror, there's still going to be individuals that are engaged. See, and they will ever continue to appear to challenge the shamans or priests, even if, you know, once all the shamans are gone, and it's when it's priests, shamans or priests of any age who oppose general education and attempt to thwart scientific progress. Now, that part at the end, see, is very interesting. Because that's, think about that for a second. They're pointing out that, okay, it's like, well, I can understand, like, why there would have been a number of, say, the Old Testament prophets being engaged by the Melchizedek receivers, right? This special circumstance because of the rebellion and the fault, and the receivers are trying to keep things going. They're making these very kind of exceptional engagements with individuals, you know, like Elijah or, you know, or whomever. Okay, but this is obviously, it's like, set that sort of stuff aside. This is talking about in a more general sense. On every world, no rebellion, no default. You know, and you're going, well, what's the, you know, why? You know, what's going on here? When they say general education and, you know, and scientific progress, oh, wait, there's, every world has master seraphim. Okay, and they're telling, you know, not only do Master Seraphim, you know, each group of Master Seraphim have destiny reservists, you know, that they can activate in an emergency, but even in a non-emergency general situation, like, you know, what about those Master Seraphim that foster education? They're pointing out that occasionally they're going to use this mode. You know, where it's not a reservist, but it's an individual that's being engaged in a more conscious mode rather than a superconscious mode, and fostering them to be a more focused influence in the evolutionary process. So that's a see, when you really reflect on all the details there, there's some interesting things between the lines of that paragraph. You know, that they don't talk about directly when they're talking about the Master Seraphim. You know, they kind of just, you know, tell you that there's all these seraphim working on all these things, and you're going to say, well, how do they do that? You know, and your thought's like, well, I suppose maybe they could kind of do it some through the cosmic reservists, you know, in a more conscious way. Yeah. Okay, but this is pointing out, you know, there's another mode. This is kind of more in the mode of, you know, when you read the Celestial Artisans paper, and they tell you that there really are muses, right? And they really do influence some select artists, some kind of chosen people, right? Quote unquote. Yep.
Easy to not think that they're not talking about us. And any age who oppose general education and attempt to thwart scientific progress, mm-hmm. they couldn't be talking about us. Could they? I mean, in this time, well, and actually, what do they mean by general education?
Yeah, right.
What is being taught in today's school?
Yeah, notice how pregnant the paragraph is when you really pause and start to think about it. There's a lot of stuff to think about there. You know, exactly what it is, what do you mean by general education, and you know, who might be one of these individuals today? You know, maybe I shouldn't be completely dismissive of someone who claims to kind of have some quote-unquote inspiration. Maybe they're not totally just buying into the old shamanic woo-woo mode. Maybe there's some validity to the individual. Now, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't still approach them critically, because, you know, when something is happening consciously, right, that's problematic. I mean, the person's preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices can get in the way. Okay? So, you know, you don't just decide that they're one of these special individuals and then turn your brain off and just do whatever they say. Okay.
Well, what passes for education today leaves not all, but many people who get through a higher education have any common sense they may have started with taught out of them.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Right. You know, obviously with, you know, education, you know, go back to paper 16, section 6. Right? What's the purpose of education? Right? So, you know, you can appreciate what these people would be attempting to influence, that, you know, fundamental fostering of your cosmic insight through the three cosmic intuitions. Yeah, so anyway, that's kind of some interesting stuff there with that paragraph. Is there a
melt? I was just thinking Tenskwatawa wasn't like someone who fits any archetype for being a prophet. He was like, you know, a wild guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, quote unquote, he was a wild guy. It was last little footnote I was going to give before we went on to the next paragraph is how this ties into something we've already talked about. One of his main programs was witch burning.
Yeah.
Okay. Tenskwatawa was really big on clearing out all that foolish magic stuff. And he took a very direct hand at it, and just burn them all.
Yeah.
Okay. So, see, again, the challenge there. It's like, well, anyone would be burning witches. You know, I mean, after all, they just said, many comparatively recent exhibitions of religious intolerance, anyone who would show such religious intolerance would never be a true prophet. Are you sure? They just told you one classic witch burner, very well-known witch burner, was indeed a genuine prophet. Okay? You know, and Moses also, did lots of executing. It's like, oh, this is too complicated. Let's just kill all these guys, and everyone else will, will get the point. He took a very direct hand a lot of times. Yeah, and so that reminds you. It's like, well, are we that different now? Is it possible that we can just be very, very soft-handed with everyone all the time? And we're you're probably still going to have to be pretty heavy-handed at times with some people. Does anyone have the stomach for that anymore? Okay, even if you don't literally kill people, you're still going to have to probably be quite heavy-handed about it. And you can't just say, well, anyone who's heavy-handed is mean. We don't want anyone that's mean as a leader. Yeah, it's like, well, okay, forget about Moses then. Right? And what would the world be like if there wasn't Moses? Think about that for a second. Yeah, that would be a dark place.
We're not done with those techniques.
Yeah. All right, let's keep going here.
In many ways, and by devious methods, the olden shamans established their reputations as voices of God and custodians of providence. They sprinkled the newborn with water and conferred names upon them. They circumcised the males. They presided over all burial ceremonies, and made due announcement of the safe arrival of the dead in spirit land.
They did that complete lifestyle solution thing that a proper Christian priest does. Yeah. Right. Yep. So there's just, obviously that's the point of that paragraph. Just like, wait a minute, that sounds like, right, that's that whole, get your fingers into everything, of the last, of the most recent centuries of religion. Yeah.
The shamanic priests and medicine men often became very wealthy through the accretion of their various fees, which were ostensibly offerings to the spirits. Not infrequently, a shaman would accumulate practically all the material wealth of his tribe. Upon the death of a wealthy man, it was customary to divide his property equally with the shaman and some public enterprise or charity. This practice still obtains in some parts of Tibet, where one half the male population belongs to this class of non-producers.
Ooh, ouch. Yeah, yeah, another non-gentle statement. Yeah. Like this class of non-producers. But, you know, see, I was already alluding to this, you know, so we've kind of already talked about this. See, but here, this is the deal. I mean, not infrequently, a shaman would accumulate practically all the material wealth of his tribe. So, yep, I'm going to be a weather shaman, right? I do the risk-reward assessment. The reward is great. Okay, and we haven't even read the next paragraph yet. So, you know, this is why they would take on these such a risky profession, because of the near infinite rewards potential.
Like their excuse for failing cost someone else of their life. Like, well, what's his name had a rock in his pocket.
Yeah.
But it didn't work.
That's why it didn't work. Yep.
The shamans dressed well and usually had a number of wives. They were the original aristocracy, being exempt from all tribal restrictions. They were very often of low-grade mind and morals. They suppressed their rivals by denominating them witches or sorcerers, and very frequently rose to such positions of influence and power that they were able to dominate the chiefs or kings.
Yeah, see, not just all of the material wealth, but, you know, it gives you all the fineries, you know, and number of wives. Right, so, yeah. You know, and you get to be one of the elites. You get to be one of the aristocracy. Now, yeah, at the same time, okay, there is some validity, as we were pointing out. I mean, you have to have some significant intellectual powers here, right, to be successful at this job. Okay, so there is some validity to the aristocracy label, even though they were very often of low grade mind and morals. See, so it's, you know, obviously that statement is in a much higher sense, right? They don't think of these individuals as being the kind of minds that you have on a normal world in the post-Pistole Sun Age. Okay, relative to that, we're talking about low-grade mind and morals. Okay, but nonetheless, relatively speaking, they had some specific, you know, insight and cleverness and whatnot that. So they were above the run of the mill. And again, you just think about Tenskwatawa, right? They suppressed their rivals by denominating them witches or sorcerers. And right. See, so this is a tricky thing. I mean, you know, obviously there aren't really witches, right? And so why are we killing them? But in the process of evolving civilization, even if it's for selfish ends, like they're pointing out here, you can't go very far with civilization when it's bogged down with all of this foolishness. And so, if you know, it's like evolving from many gods to one god, right? If you get it all kind of coalesced in a small number of individuals, then it's easier to kind of move that forward than if it's just ubiquitous. Okay. So again, all this stuff in a very crude way, you know, can be worked. The evolution can work with it and move it forward, but it's, you know, it's ugly for individuals at the time, right?
Okay. Primitive man regarded the shaman as a necessary evil. He feared him, but did not love him. Early man respected knowledge. He honored and rewarded wisdom. The shaman was mostly fraud, but the veneration for shamanism well illustrates the premium put upon wisdom in the evolution of the race.
So they're pointing out, see, again, when all is said and done, not only, does it lead to early man respecting knowledge, but notice how we shoved wisdom aside, but it eventually comes back around. Because in this dog eat dog world, for who gets to be the remaining shaman, the more you don't just have insight and foresight, but wisdom, insight, and foresight, the more likely you're going to be the surviving one. So, yeah, it's an ugly process, but it does slowly come back around and move things forward. Okay. And just like we'll, think of, a necessary evil, just because all politicians are deceitful, if you generalize like that, okay, doesn't mean we can somehow do it without politicians. There's a lot of necessary evils that have to you just have to let it be. It's part of the evolutionary process. You can't go all absolutist and existential about it, okay? It doesn't mean that you don't try to foster things to get better, but don't overplay the significance of the limitations of what's in front of you at the moment. Okay. All right, so I'll just keep chugging along. Next time, we've got a lot more about here, about the influence of the shamans. And notice that we didn't have to go very far, and they were at least between the lines because we were looking for it. We started to see the positive things. And, that it was important for us to kind of feel that tension up front, to be looking for that, because it allowed us to get into the truth flowing through the paragraphs better.
Yeah. It's just interesting to think of things around in today. Like, what's the difference between a soothsayer and a pundit? there's a lot of commonality here.
Yeah, right. Yeah, for those in the webinar, you're saying, so what's the difference between a soothsayer and a pundit? Right, all these things that get you to reflect on what's in front of you today. And, I recognize that. That's that same old thing. Different name, same phenomenon. It'll help you to have a better relationship with what's in front of you today, to be more patient with it, more and more insightful about how you can relate to it, how you can engage it, possibly foster its progress forward, right? I mean, you must face facts and adjust them to ideals in order to achieve wisdom. If you can't face facts, if you aren't seeing what's in front of you in this objective, factual way, if you have all kinds of illusions and delusions about it, right, there's going to be problems. All right. So anyway, we'll pick up where we left off here next time. Let's take a moment here, everyone.